right, we have noted before that the first 12 chapters of the book of Joshua is a discussion of the military campaigns that enable the Israelites to defeat all of the dominant powers there in the promised land of Canaan and to become themselves the dominant power. That's the first 12 chapters of the book, and we're really coming to the climax of that first half here. Joshua 11 and 12 is a discussion of the northern campaign and what ultimately would be the final major campaign that Israel wages that they might gain control of the promised land. I think it's important to remember kind of how the overall warfare, how it occurred when they entered into the promised land. You recall they had the central campaign crossing the Jordan River and defeating Jericho, ultimately Ai and Bethel. Then the southern campaign, and we talked about that last time, where this coalition of kings led by Adonizedek, the king of Jerusalem, a five-city coalition, really fell right into the hands of the Israelites. That coalition attacked Gibeon. Joshua marches all night, surprises them, and the Lord fighting with them with the hailstones and ultimately enable the Israelites to have a tremendous victory. The long day that we talked about last time, enabling them to just completely, on this occasion, wipe out those major forces in the southern part of the nation or the southern part of the promised land. Okay, well, now we come to the northern campaign, the third major campaign, and it's going to be up near the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula up in the northern part of Galilee, and it will be a coalition led by the king of Hazor, King Jabin, and not just one, but numerous city-states that join forces with Jabin, king of Hazor, to go into battle against Israel. And so this is what we're talking about when we look at chapter 11 and 12. So last time we looked at the southern campaign and this five-city coalition. I want us now to look at the northern campaign, and let's just begin with verse 1 of chapter 11. Then it came about when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it, about the conquest of the southern part of Palestine, of Israel, when the king of Hazor heard of it, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and the king of Achsaph, and to the kings who were of the north in the hill country, and in the Arabah, south of Kimaroth, and in the lowland, and on the heights of Dor on the west, to the Canaanite on the east and on the west, and the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Jebusite in the hill country, and the Hivite in the foot of Hermon in the land of Mizpah. They came out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. So all of these kings, having agreed to meet, came and encamped together at the waters of Merom, to fight against Israel. There's a lot of significance in what we just read. It's not just a list of cities. I want everyone to really appreciate what the text is talking about. First of all, it's talking about Hazor. This particular Canaanite city of Hazor, we'll look in more detail at Hazor in just a little bit, but it's located about 10 miles or so north of the Sea of Galilee, about 5 miles south of Lake Hula. When your Old Testament talks about Lake Chinneroth, that's the Old Testament name for the Sea of Galilee. When it talks about the waters of Merom, that's the Old Testament name for Lake Hula. And so Hazor is the main city that the text is talking about, and Jabin, the king of Hazor, is the one who initiates this multi-city coalition to fight against Israel. That name, Jabin, Yabin in Hebrew, Again, that's a dynastic name. That's not his given name. That's his royal title, like Pharaoh of Egypt. Okay. Well, the city-state of Hazor, they called their king Yabin or Jabin, we would say in English. So that's what the text is talking about. This particular king of Hazor, who's reigning at that time, he hears about the success that Israel has had in the southern part of the nation. And you go back and look at those verses again, it talks about just all the numerous people of Canaan, the numerous city-states in this whole area that he is organizing to form a coalition against Israel. The text talks about all the kings of the city-states in this general area where Hazor is. It talks about city-states beyond the Jordan River in the northern part of this Araba region, going all the way toward Mount Hermon. It talks about all of those in this area here of Galilee. So, I mean, this is just a tremendous geographical area, the city-states of which Jabin, king of Hazor, is organizing into a coalition. Now, what's the significance of this coalition in comparison with the previous coalition down south? What strikes you? You got a lot more people involved. That coalition of forces down south was a 5-city-state coalition. And of course, the Lord fought for them, and they were able to gain a great, great victory over that 5-city coalition down south. But when you're reading these verses, make sure that you see the significance of this. This is not just 5 city-states. In fact, what number is given? There isn't a number. It isn't just 5, or it's not even some number that the author Joshua is giving as far as the number of city-states. It's just a multitude of city-states all in this area, and the accumulated force is so large that he describes it how? Like the sands on the seashore. Okay, that's what the narrator is trying to emphasize here. If the 5-city coalition down south looked formidable and was frightening, and it certainly was to the Israelites at first, and God had to encourage Joshua and the people on that occasion, just imagine now what would be entering into their minds as this accumulation of forces, and they accumulate near Hazor, near the waters of Lake Kula or Merom, your Bible say. And so this is a tremendous force. And so look at then verse 6. I get a little feedback right there, I guess. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid because of them. For tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." Once again, I want to ask you the question. The fact that God says to Joshua and the people, "Do not be afraid," what does that imply? They were afraid. Potentially, this is something that would strike fear in their hearts. And that's why God feels the need to encourage them. And I think you can understand why. In other words, look at what we're seeing as the various battles in the conquest of Canaan have unfolded. It started out with Jericho. Started out with Ai. One city at a time. Then you've got a coalition of 5 cities that go up against Israel. All right, now you've got a multi-city coalition. You can't even number the people there. So the enemy forces are getting greater and greater all the time. That's the point. And so here what it looks like, it is the greatest force that Israel has yet had to face, The Lord says, don't be afraid. Tomorrow I'm going to give them into your hand. What's the point when God says, you shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire? Craig, you started to talk to me about this after class. What's the point of that? Horses and chariots, and so you hamstring the horses, which does what? Yeah, sure can't use them as military horses anymore. That's it, right? Burn the chariots, but those chariots are a great military weapon. Why would God want to burn the chariots, hamstring the horses? It's an ultimate message from God, is that's not what you need to win your victories. They hadn't relied upon war horses before. They hadn't relied upon war chariots before. So they don't need those as spoils of war to accumulate those. God is fighting for them. God is enabling them to defeat this kind of power. So they don't need to just take those as spoils of war for their own arsenal. Okay. So God is saying, I'm going to give them into your hand tomorrow, and it's going to be a great, great victory. So be of good courage, and you will win. Did somebody raise a hand? Yeah, Tom. It's a great point, and especially coming from someone who's not a military strategist. That's a great, great point. And in fact, let's just kind of amplify what Tommy's saying, because I think this is something that I don't believe that we have emphasized. Has Israel had some kind of trained standing army here? No, they had been living as a nomadic people for 40 years in the wilderness. Okay? They were not some trained army, you know, raw recruits, as you said. So they are certainly young, inexperienced, not a warfaring people by any means. And so all that enhances what we're seeing that God is able to do with them. Very good. Yeah, Johnny. Right, that second generation, 20 and older. They did. They did. Sure, sure. Okay. All right, so look at verse 7. So Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. Let me just pause there. What's the significance of that? What strikes you about that? They're on the offensive, and they're seemingly, from a normal military strategist point of view, they're the underdog. They're going to be in trouble, and what do? They attack. verse 8, the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as Great Sidon. That's over in Phoenician territory along the Mediterranean coast. And Misrephoth Maim in the valley of Mizpah to the east, and they struck them until no survivor was left to them. Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. All right, now let's talk about something else here as we kind of back up and look at the bigger picture of Israel's conquest of these various Canaanite powers. Does anything strike you as to how it is that they achieve this victory against this formidable force in comparison with the way that they had achieved their previous victories. Don't see any hailstones from the Lord like had happened down south in the southern campaign. Okay.
I think you're all on the right track. But just kind of back up
and assess. Okay, everybody be a military strategist here. Just back up and assess these battles. Starting with the central campaign, the southern campaign, and now the northern campaign. How was Israel able to gain victory in all of these? Just look at the overall picture. Do you see any kind of development here? When you look at the overall picture of their conquest of these three sections of Canaan. Tommy. Okay. Well, that's ultimately what we want to see. But, I mean, how is it that the Lord gives them victory?
Defeating them all in the entire region, one single battle.
Right. Absolutely. So all that played into their hands.
Seems like they're surprised when they take off and run.
Right. This is where my wife, if she were here, she'd be saying, just tell them. Okay. The very first city that they attacked. How did they gain that victory against Jericho? It wasn't so much a surprise attack. They marched around the city for 7 days. But how did they defeat Jericho, the very first city? It was a great miracle, wasn't it? I mean, you know, normally when you shout, you know, walls don't fall down, you know. So, I mean, you know, they march around the city and they shout, and these walls just fall down flat. The Lord gave them a tremendous, miraculous victory. Okay? Now, the southern portion of the promised land. How did they gain such a great victory of all of that territory? Bill, you said it a moment ago. Well, but the Lord is the one who sent hailstones. And that's a great miracle. Now, hail falling is a natural phenomenon, but it's hitting the enemy. It's not hitting Israel. And in fact, so there's the miraculous nature of it. And so what we saw is that more of the Canaanites down south were defeated, killed by the hailstones than even the swords of Israel. Right? Okay, so now they're going up north, and it's the third and final of the campaigns that they are waging. And now, according to what the text tells us, how is it that the Lord gives them victory? All right, now Craig says they do it themselves. Now that's probably not the best way to phrase it. What I mean, the Lord's still with them and fighting for them, but what you mean is what? It's not a miraculous thing. There's no mention of any kind of, you know, miracle from God. There's no walls falling down. There's no hailstones. You know, there's nothing like that from God. Now what you see is that through what we would say natural means, they're able to have the greatest victory that they've had yet. Now, would you conclude from all that, based upon all the precedent, that Israel, by their own power, was able to defeat Hazor and this multi-city coalition? Absolutely not. But what we're seeing here is that the Lord, He doesn't have to work miracles to give some great victory. In fact, this is the greatest victory that they've had. It's the most formidable collection of the enemy that they've ever faced. And the Lord is with them, and through natural fighting means, they absolutely devastate these armies. I think there's a great lesson there. And this is what I think a lot of times people miss when they read the Bible just in a very cursory fashion. There's so many people that, you know, say, oh, well, in Old Testament times, God just working miracles right and left.
Oh, yeah, I can be
faithful at a time. God works miracles, you know. Wish he worked miracles for me. And people kind of have the idea that that if you live back in that time, it's just miracle after miracle after miracle. No, it wasn't. In fact, what you see is that it's only at very significant points in Old Testament history that God works miracles, and most of the time, he isn't working miraculously, but is he still working for his people? Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, this is what God is teaching them. He has always been with them, and the first city that they conquered was through a tremendous miraculous victory, but they wind up at the climax of their conquest of Canaan, and God delivers them into their hands through very natural military means, but they just whip up on them. Okay, I think there's a tremendous point there. We don't need to think that God has to work miracles in order to be working. I think that's one of the strong lessons that we're getting here when we read the book of Joshua. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, Nancy.
Why having a big coalition? It was interesting to me that the people came out of the cities into the battlefield and were killed on the battlefield, leaving the cities intact for the Israelites to take over. But didn't they still have to go into the cities and kill the women and the children?
Yeah. I know. And again, all of this was this act of judgment from God. And it had reached a point where they were so wicked. Every generation was so wicked. That's what God was having to do. But the fact that you've got now these coalitions and the soldiers coming out on the battlefield, once they are defeated, then that makes the cities from which they came virtually sitting ducks. And making it much easier then in the aftermath for the Israelites to and take over all of those cities. In the case of Hazor, that we'll talk about in just a moment, actually burn it. Okay. Agnes.
It says in verse 22, what is an Afghan?
Okay. What do I normally do, Agnes, when you ask questions in class and you can't stand it? You want to throw something at me?
I do.
I'm going to get to it in just a minute. Okay, and if that second bell's fixed to ring and I haven't commented on that, you throw something at me and get my attention and I will comment on that, I promise you. Craig?
I think you can see a progression. You talk about in the campaign, for all our groups, it would be very difficult to throw all the groups against a massive number like this, say, in the part of the war.
That's a good point. Wasn't God training the Israelites during during these years? So now they are able, through God's providential, non-miraculous help, but they are able to do what they were called upon to do now militarily. And they probably wouldn't have been able on their own means to do it earlier. I think that's a great point. Well, the overall time period that we're talking about, I mean, there's no actual dates given in the text, but the overall time period that we're talking about appears to be around 10 plus years, you know, right in there. John?
I'm just wondering, I understand your point as far as the change in how God delivered. But do you not think that maybe the reason that there were such clear and overt miracles that it was not the Israelites might have just also been the point to the Canaanites that they were being judged by God,
and
it was a higher power than this army, and that they were to know that their time had come, and there's no question as to who they are now given account.
It's a great point, John. I think all of that's involved in this.
It just seems to me that it was, I mean, word has to get out that this military is circling the city of Jericho, and then all of a sudden the walls come in. There's no doubt as to how that could have happened. And then when the hailstorm comes, that's the southern region. There's no doubt. Well, within the northern region, you're not making a point anymore to them because they're the last region. And
points
now the point is that they've got everybody they could possibly bring against the smallest force, and they win. I mean, the people of Israel win. And so to me, it kind of seems like God was just delivering the message more so to the Canaanites.
I think all of that. I don't think this is an either-or thing. I think all of that's involved in this. In fact, really what you see, and you see this so many times in the Old Testament, one message that God is sending is about himself. You know, he is God. Yahweh is God. But the other point that so often he wants to make is who the people of Yahweh are. And I think that's what you see here is that, you know, yes, Yahweh's power and all that struck fear into the hearts of the Canaanites. So now they see this as him judging them, and he's judging them by the means of these Israelite people, again, who don't need miracles to come in and just wipe them out. As long as Yahweh is the God fighting with them.
That's the greatest miracle was the northern campaign because there were no, I mean, look, you got supernatural means defeating all the other ones. There were no supernatural means, but yet they overcame the greatest of all odds to defeat them.
I think that's, when you read the first 12 chapters of Joshua, I think there is this progression, and I think that's the ultimate message that you are seeing, is here's the greatest victory of all, the greatest, most difficult battle of all, and yet, look at how God is able to handle this with them. Yeah. John?
Just thinking of the promise that he had made in the first chapter to Joshua and to the people, about, you follow me, I'll be with you. That's demonstrated in every one of those cases. Like you say, in the first two, they followed his word. It was a miracle. Now he's putting a lot in the providence, giving providence to the people, but they still followed exactly what he told them to do.
Absolutely. Very good. Okay. Well, let's look now at just some things here in reference to this area of Hazor. In fact, let's go ahead and just read verses 10 and following, and then I want to show you some things here. Verse 10. Then Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor and struck its king with a sword, for Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. They struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was no one left who breathed, and he burned Hazor with fire. Joshua captured all the cities of these kings and all their kings, and he struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed them, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. And by the way, you're going to see that line, that refrain, over and over again, that they destroyed these cities just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. Okay? In fact, why had God commanded that? Why had God commanded them, make sure you utterly destroy? Act of judgment. And the implied secondary point, you know, not leaving them there in the land would also prevent what? Them corrupting the Israelites further. So those, and that's why God had given that command. So that's what Joshua's doing. And so this kind of ties in with the point John made earlier. You know, they are doing everything at the behest of God exactly as God had said through Moses. All right, verse 13. However, Israel did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds except Hazor alone, which Joshua burned. All the spoil of these cities and the cattle the sons of Israel took as their plunder, but they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. They left no one who breathed, just as the Lord had commanded Moses his servant. So Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. So, again, the emphasis on doing everything as God had commanded. And they burned Hazor, But they did not burn and destroy the other cities. Why would they not have wanted to destroy all the other cities? They're going to occupy them. Okay, they're conquering this territory in order to dwell in it. Okay, but why did they destroy Hazor then? Symbolic why? What? Because Hazor, what's true about Hazor? It's the head of all those northern city-states. Okay, so it's the most dominant. Now, this is a photograph of this area of Hazor. All of this area was occupied. I think it's about a 25-acre area. All of this area was occupied during the second millennium B.C. And like the first part of the first millennium B.C. But this upper section, this is where the upper part of the city, the citadel was, the fortified area. After the time of Solomon, and going on down to the time of Ahab, when he rebuilds this city, this upper portion is all that is rebuilt. At the time of Joshua, all of that was occupied. Let me just show you some things here. Here's the temple. There's been a major excavation that's been going on at Hazor for at least two decades, maybe even longer than that. But they have uncovered this temple at Hazor, which would have been the temple perhaps at the time of Joshua, maybe just before the time of Joshua, but it certainly gives you an idea of what we're talking about here with this pagan city. As you can see, you got the modern structure here. There's just been a standing excavation going on for a number of years. But this is this temple area that was dedicated to the god Baal, who was, of course, the god of the thunderstorm. He was the chief Canaanite deity throughout that area. All of this is still the temple area at Hazor. The entrance to that temple, you had several of these lions that were there kind of guarding the temple. That's kind of typical pagan architecture there. And so these lions are guarding the temple. This is the altar. I have no idea who that person is. But this is the altar at Hazor. And I happen to think, well, maybe it's kind of fitting there is a person atop that altar, because sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes the Canaanites would sacrifice not merely animals, but also human beings. So is that a girl or a boy? I can't tell. But anyway, better get off there quick, probably. I don't know. But this is the area that I especially wanted you to see that I think is significant. This is the area where archaeologists uncovered a whole bunch of cultic images. If you look at Jerry, likes to talk about these standing stones. You had to have those all through the ancient world as cultic objects. Stones that are erected for some purpose of memory, to commemorate a particular site or to commemorate particular people. And so what you have here are all of these stones that are erected. They're called in Hebrew masabot, and they're usually translated standing stones, upright stones. Here's a picture of some of these. And if you look at this, I think I got a better picture here. You've got two arms there, two hands, and what's that symbolizing? Two hands reaching up to heaven, that's symbolizing prayer. This was a typical prayer posture in the ancient world. Not the only prayer posture, but a very, very common one. It wasn't just modern-day charismatics that came up with that. In fact, they kind of borrowed that. But this idea of reaching one's hands up to God and praying, that was very common in the ancient world. And that's what you see here memorialized in this particular set of standing stones. And I wanted to show you this. This is actually an altar. It's been knocked down, but they left it in situ, in its place. This is an altar there to Baal. And I want you just to see this. That looks like a wheel with spokes, but What that's representing is the circle of the earth, or the concept of the circumference of the earth. And of course, you know, we've got the sky overhead, and the point of that is it's claiming that Baal, this great Canaanite deity to whom this temple is dedicated, that Baal is the Lord of all the heavens. Any direction you go, the four directions, Baal is supposedly the god of all that area. Which is kind of interesting that we see that on this knockdown altar, a temple to Baal that has been destroyed. way to go, Baal. And the archaeological work that has been done here has shown that this particular area, though the temple was rebuilt, that this area of Hazor was destroyed around 1200 BC, somewhere in that area of time, and it's generally thought that that is exactly the destruction layer that we're reading about here when the text says that Hazor was the one northern city-state that was actually burned, destroyed by Israel. And so this particular site would not have been occupied again. So there's great significance in all of this. And you have to appreciate the religious symbolism, kind of like John was talking about a moment ago, that here is Yahweh, the God of Israel, who's coming in and conquering this area that supposedly is the stronghold of Baal. Because he's supposed to be the God who has ultimate power in all of this area. We don't know if this is a deity or if this is a nobleman, but this little figure was found among the ruins. Little tiny figure, there's a little fly right there. That's how small it is. There's a little fly that landed when they took the shot. But that's either a nobleman or a god. This is going down into the cistern that held water there at Hazor. That's just a picture of the cistern. Later, the Israelites would occupy this city again during the monarchy period. Solomon would rebuild that area, and this is the water shaft that in Solomon's day he constructed or had constructed. And these steps go down into the water shaft. It wasn't a spring, but it just would take you down to the water table level. And you can even take a tour today and go down this water shaft, dating back to the time of Solomon when Israel had control at that time. So I just wanted you to see all of this and appreciate that what the text is talking about Hazor being destroyed, that the archaeologists have certainly discovered the remains of that particular time period and that destruction. Now, I want to just real quickly get to some final things. Well, wait, any comments on any of that? Okay. Look at verses 16 and following, and we're kind of pressed for time here, but it is recounting now then the kind of the mop-up battles, okay, as Joshua and the forces are going in, taking care of all of these kings that are left over. And I want you to come down to verse 20, or verse 19. There was not a city which made peace with the sons of Israel except the Hivites living in Gibeon. They took them all in battle. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts to meet Israel in battle in order that he might utterly destroy them, that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And again, I think we just have to emphasize the point the text is emphasizing. Yes, this is coming in and wiping out these people, men, women, and children. And they are not seeking peace with Israel. They're not seeking to make peace with Israel. Okay, Gibeon is the only one that did that, and they did that through subterfuge. But the text is saying that the Lord hardened their hearts so he might come in full judgment upon them. What does that remind you of? It's exactly the same thing that we learned about God doing with Pharaoh. Is that talking about God in some supernatural way forcing the Canaanite people to not submit to Israel? Is it talking about that? Is that what God did with Pharaoh? Now, it's not talking about some supernatural kind of hardening of the heart, but what it's saying is that God was, again, providentially using these circumstances, knowing it's going to harden these wicked people's hearts. They're not going to submit to Yahweh. You know, Rahab was an exception, a notable exception, that individual woman. But what you see is all of these city-states, they do not submit to the obvious power of Israel and their God, Yahweh. And as a result of that hardening of heart, it allows God very justifiably to go in and render his judgment and therefore demonstrate to everybody who would hear about this, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is truly God. It's a powerful message that is being sent here. Okay? Now I want to get to the next verse that talks about the Anakim, but let me... Okay, I thought that was... Okay. All right. Look at down at verse 22. There were no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel. Only in Gaza, in Gath, and Ashdod some remained. So Joshua took the whole land. There's a little note there about the sons of Anak, or the Anakim. Does anyone know the significance of that? Who they are? What that term means? Jeremy?
Weren't they the people that were despised
that were like that? Yeah. Go over real quick to Numbers chapter 13. The term Anakim, or sons of Anak, refers to a group of people that were known for their great size. Now, you'll hear people talking about, well, giants. Well, that doesn't mean giant in some, you know, fairy tale kind of sense. But you know, a giant people, just very large of stature and very frightening as a result. And if you go back to Numbers chapter 13, verses 32 and 33, when the first generation of Israel had initially came out of Egypt, had just left Sinai, intending to go into Canaan and to start the conquest, they sent out spies, and the majority of those spies said, "We can't take it. We're not powerful enough." Verse 32, So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size." They then explain what they mean by that. "There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, or part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight." Okay, so the Anakim are a particular Canaanite tribe or sub-tribe that were just known for their tremendous size. And previously, they had been ones that the spies of Israel had just gotten so afraid of. Well, if this is how the Canaanites are, then we can't take them. All right, do you see the significance now here in Joshua? The Anakim, who seemed in the past to be so frightened, they're just
part of the population.
They're nothing. They're nothing to the army of Israel, because the army of Israel is the army of Yah. There's just great significance in all of this. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah, Mickey. Absolutely, yeah.
They had faith.
Rahab, yeah.
And they knew that, and their faith was saved.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, next time, we're going to quickly go through chapter 12, which is very easy for us to go through that. And I'd like you then to keep going in the second half of Joshua, chapters 13 and 14. Okay? All right, thank you, folks.